pistols drawn in the room. Concentrate. Hudson eased himself toward a controlled calmness. Talk to them. Keep talking to Montserrat.
I have one question before I leave. May I?
May I ask one question?
Montserrat nodded.
What harm?
You may ask anything.
Then perhaps I have a question.
Colonel Hudson watched Montserrat's eyes as he spoke. He saw nothing there, no effect, no emotion. The two of them were close in so many ways.
How long have you been with the Russians?
How long have you been one of their mole?
I was always with the Russians, Colonel. I am a Russian. My parents were stationed in America. They were among hundreds of agents who came here in the late 1940s. I was taught to be American. There are others like me. They are all over the U.S. waiting, Colonel. We want to destroy the United States financially and in every other way. 14 seconds. 12 seconds. 10 seconds. Hudson kept counting in his head, kept talking in a monotone to Francois Montserrat.
Harry Stemkowski. Do you remember a man named Stemkowski?
Poor, crippled sergeant.
One of my men?
One of the casualties of war. Your war, Colonel, not ours. He wouldn't betray you under any circumstances.
As he reached 3 in his countdown, Hudson took 2 fast, unexpected steps to his left. Both Russian terrorists swung up their pistols to fire. Too late. Hudson tucked his chin down hard against his chest. He dove headfirst through a glass window pane, crashing into the factory section of the building. At that moment, the entire building shook from the first round from the M60s, which completely pulverized the tenement's fourth floor. Flash fires broke out in 3 separate areas of the factory. Bright orange and crimson flames danced, straining to reach the stained yellow ceiling. Huge panes of glass buckled, then leaped from their casements and crashed to the cement below. Everywhere, the old struts and supports of the building were beginning to sag, warped by the rising heat, the hungry reaches of the laughing flames. M16 rifles coughed and rattled everywhere. The Vets' attack was underway. Hudson waited in a combat crouch behind heavy factory machines. The thick smoke from the fire was an advantage and his enemy at the same time. The billowing smoke and flames made it impossible for Montserrat and his people to locate Hudson, but it also made him vulnerable, exposed to attack from any side. At that instant, Hudson heard the sound he'd been waiting for. The whirring of the helicopter rotors was loud and clear. The Cobra had arrived on the rooftop, exactly as they'd planned it. Everything was perfect, right to the final escape. Colonel Hudson finally allowed himself a trace of a smile. Just a trace. Chapter 91.
Get the fuck out of my way! Move it! Move it! Move! Move! Move!
A roaring, unbelievable firefight had erupted. Carroll saw rows of flat rooftops shooting flames as he pushed and elbowed his way through the crowd, already gathered on Brooklyn's Halsey Street, to watch the action. Ghouls, he thought. The worst kind of ambulance chasers. He winced in pain. His left arm was numb and something was wrong with his spine. When he ran like this, the contact of his heels with the pavement sent jarring shudders climbing up his backbone. None of the neighborhood people, leather-jacketed teenagers, sullen young women, small, grinning children, seemed to realize that this violent spectacle was for real. They were shrieking with what almost sounded like joy.
"Get back, damn it, get back!" Carroll yelled as he ran forward. "Get inside with those kids! Get back inside your houses!"
Expectant, wide-eyed faces were crowded into every apartment window. Further down Halsey Street, hundreds of neighborhood people filed outside into the cold, rainy afternoon. They were peering toward the explosions, enthralled by the blazing fire, the sudden, jolting volleys of M16 rifle and pistol shots. Carroll continued to run in his clumsy battle crouch, moving closer to the exploding, gunshot-riddled building.
A police bullhorn boomed out to his left. It thundered over the cacophony of gun blasts and human shouts.
You there! You running! Stop right there!
Carol ignored the voices. He kept charging forward. His steps weaved as he struggled with pains that attacked his body from every direction. As he reached the fiery building, an even more familiar and terrifying sound seized his mind. The same army cobra was hovering over the factory roof. The same helicopter that had shot him down was back. Greenband was here. His body low to the ground, Carol vaulted up the building's stone steps. He took the stairs three at a time and with each leap thought he could hear the rattle of his own skeleton, loose bones flying under his flesh. A heavy-set man suddenly burst out of the open doorway in front of Carol. He was holding an 870 riot gun across his chest. Carol's gun was set on rapid repeat. A round of 30-caliber bullets disintegrated the terrorist's face. He reeled back inside the doorway. The smoke, forcing itself out of the broken first-floor windows, took root in Carol's lung. He kept running. Then Carol was climbing over the body of the dying gunman sprawled inside the doorway. Instinctively, Carol hugged the hallway wall, cheek tight against cold, peeling plaster. He gasped. His head seemed to be spinning at an unbelievable speed. An Army Cobra helicopter? How did they manage a Cobra? Getting an Army Cobra wasn't possible. Green Band was waiting upstairs, and that didn't seem possible either. Chapter 92. A grated iron door opened slowly onto the tenement rooftop. Columns of smoke scattered by the wind temporarily blurred Hudson's vision. The doorway was less than 40 yards from the waiting Cobra helicopter. Colonel Hudson walked cautiously at first. Then he began to trot like a victorious athlete toward the waiting Cobra. He'd done it. They had all done their jobs almost perfectly. The Green Band mission was finally over. The sudden exhilaration of victory was unbelievable to Saver. Hudson never saw the second figure on the roof until the assailant was on top of him. His heart squeezed into his throat. He'd been careless. For once, just once, he'd forgotten to check. To double-check every possibility. You can stop right there, Colonel. Face and shoulders still obscured in shadow, a figure appeared from behind the water tower. One hand, which held a revolver, preceded the rest of the body. Then a face came into the light. A face came into the light. François Montserrat stood fully exposed before Colonel Hudson. Montserrat smiled. A final smile of triumph. My congratulations, Colonel. You nearly achieved the perfect crime. Chapter 93. Carol was unsure which way to head inside the burning tenement building. He choked on a thick gust of smoke and thought he was going to be sick. His lungs chafed as if they'd been rubbed down by sandpaper. Crackling reports of M-16s, booming incendiary bombs rang against his eardrum. He could make out the sharp, repeating sound of the rotors of the Cobra helicopter that had landed on the rooftop. Montserrat and Colonel Hudson were inside the building. Carol coughed and gasped as he climbed sets of steep, winding stairs. All around him, flames curled at shadows, throwing off violently flickering light and heat. The shooting pain in his legs was unbearable. Something felt wrong, cracked at the base of his spine. At the head of the stairs, there was a heavy metal door blocking his way. It stuck at first. Then Carol put his shoulder into it hard. He shouldered the stubborn door a second time. The metal door finally swung open with a loud shriek. The rooftop was revealed. Carol's eyes widened. The crimson taillights of a U.S. military helicopter shone and sparkled in the haze of smoke. The Army Cobra was being readied for takeoff. The rotors were spinning out thunder and sparks. Somewhere in the smoke shrouding the rooftop, Carol heard voices. The voices were strident and angry. They originated from off to his left, beyond the high brick retaining wall. Fear raised the hammers of Carol's heart. Fear because he was finally beginning to understand. You see, you must
see that governments of the past are no longer viable. The elected governments are mere illusions. They are ghosts of a sentimentalized reality. You must understand that, at least. There are no more democracies. The voice was filled with the tension of the moment. The second voice was harsh, erupting like another gunshot in the air. The wind muffled the exact words. Whatever the second person had to say was whipped away by the roar of the chopper and the wind that was shuffling the clouds. Carol pressed his body closer to the brick wall. He edged toward the voices. The conversation became clearer now. Each word pierced the noise and swirling smoke. His heart ached from the relentless pressure. "I love this country," one of the two shouted above the wind. "I hate what it did to the veterans after the war. I hate what some of the leaders did. But I love this country." At that moment, Carol saw them both. Just as he thought he was beginning to understand, he realized that he understood nothing. Colonel David Hudson. The same man pictured in all the FBI library and Pentagon photographs. Tall, strikingly blonde, the consummate military commander, according to his classified records. And the other. Dear God, the other. Carol felt something vital subside deep inside him. It wasn't really a physical thing. It wasn't a bone or a pain in the heart, a collapse of muscle. It was worse than that. Suddenly, he remembered the first time he'd experienced the horror of death, his father's death in Florida. He remembered his exact feeling on the night Nora had died. His mouth was dry and his head a cave of sad, hopeless chaos. His emotions were wilder than the guerrilla war raging everywhere around him. He was without speech and numb. All he could do was stare straight ahead. Nothing could have prepared him for this awful moment. All his years as a policeman hadn't prepared him. The man Colonel David Hudson had addressed as Montserrat was Walter Trenkamp. Except the clenched, shadowy face Carol saw on this man was almost a stranger's. The face was ruthless and uncaring. Carol's world wheeled violently and turned on its side. Whatever sense of reality he had left shattered. He closed his eyes. He raked one hand over his smoke-blackened face. His mind's eye seemed to flood with exploding light. Uncle fucking Walter. It was the worst hurt, the worst betrayal of his life. He thought about everything Trenkamp had been privy to in the past. He reviewed his own investigation of Greenband, how Trenkamp knew every detail he'd learned at each maddening turn. Had Trenkamp dispatched him on the early wild goose chases? Why? Well, he knew the answer to that. So he could watch and control Carol. So he could control the DIA's terrorist group. Talk to me on this one, Archer. Let me know what you find out. Will you promise me that? Talk to me, Archer. Promise me, Archer. Walter Trenkamp had sat in on the highest level meetings inside the White House, always observing and studying. What incredible self-confidence and gall. How many years had this been going on? How many years? Francois Montserrat, the most ruthless of the world's terrorists, was none other than Trenkamp. It was impossible for him to conceive of. Yet it was true. The rage inside Carol seemed to clutch and rip at the back of his throat, tearing at his flesh. He'd been used. Just like the vets, he'd been used. He'd been violated one more time. Contradictions attacked his mind from every angle. Carol moved forward toward Trenkamp and Hudson. The rage inside him heightened. He was fighting against the blind, overwhelming urge to wildly fire his Browning. He wanted to pull the trigger. Right now, he ached to fire on these two men. He couldn't. He couldn't shoot. Somehow, he was more than a trained killer. And what are you, please tell me, mister? Somehow, he was more than these other two bastards. Carol finally stepped out from behind the shadowy retaining wall. He spoke in a whisper that carried with the wind. Hello, Walter. I wanted to keep my promise.
I did promise to talk to you about everything I found out. Trent Camp's face registered surprise. Then the terrorist seemed almost indifferent to Carol's presence. He was Montserrat now.
It was never anything personal, he spoke, then shrugged at Carol. You were my Liskok.
That's a Russian word. You were my solution to a problem.
Carol raised his Browning to eye level. Colonel Hudson, Francois Montserrat, himself. It seemed that none of them could win.
Carol wasn't even sure what win meant now.
And what are you? Please tell me, mister.
How do you live a life made of nothing but lies? He edged closer to Hudson and Trent Camp.
Nothing but deceit and lies.
I don't believe in the same truth as you. It follows that I don't believe in the same lies.
Don't you realize that you're living with lies, too? Your own people have deceived you again and again.
Everyone has lied to you, Archer. Your government is the greatest lie of all.
Chapter 94 Nothing but his instincts counted from here on. Colonel Hudson rigidly held that thought. Nothing but his reflexes counted. Hudson had a flashing image of the camp in North Vietnam, lessons he had learned there.
Deception, Hudson remembered. Sometimes you even had to deceive yourself.
Montserrat was like the lizard man, he thought. Montserrat was the same as the lizard man.
Instincts, reflexes.
Montserrat seemed to be concentrating on Carol.
Everyone has lied to you, Archer. Your government is the greatest lie of all.
A scream rose from Hudson's throat. At that moment, Hudson's arm chopped upward in a short, powerful arc. The bone in Montserrat's elbow shattered. The Beretta dropped. A harsh growl escaped from his mouth. His teeth were bared like an animal. A needle-thin knife seemed to appear from nowhere in Hudson's hand. A pocket in his trousers flopped open in the wind.
Assassin!
Montserrat took a fast, agile step away from Hudson and the knife. Montserrat was better than the lizard man had been. David Hudson followed as if he were Montserrat's shadow. The sleek stiletto lanced forward, an extension of his arm. Everything was instincts, reflexes for survival. Francois Montserrat's hands rose and shielded his face, shielded his upper body. His arm was slashed. It seemed nothing to him. He was moving into a martial arts crouch, almost dancing. Hudson screamed as he feinted one move, a second move. Then he struck.
Seemed to strike? Fainted?
The knife blade shivered forward with accuracy and fierceness. The surgical knife blade drove several inches into its target area. The long, piercing needle disappeared into the flesh and bone of Montserrat's ribcage. Montserrat kept coming. The knife blade was twisted, then pulled away, unplugged it seemed. The stiletto was thrust forward again. This time, it split the center of Montserrat's throat. Blood gushed everywhere. The terrorist's leg suddenly went limp. He began to convulse. His face no longer seemed smug, no longer confident and in control.
Montserrat was surprised, in shock as he fell forward.
Carol hadn't known whom to shoot. He'd watched, waiting for the victor. He trained his Browning on Colonel Hudson now. His finger tightened, turned to stone around the trigger. Suddenly he heard the distinct click of yet another automatic weapon. The disturbing sound came from directly behind him in the thickening smoke. Carol started to whirl around. His mind was suspended by pain and the moment's chaos. He needed all of the madness to stop for a moment. He saw men he thought he recognized. Four men in tattered khaki green were closing around him on the Brooklyn rooftop. Their M21s were pointed at him. They looked like soldiers Carol had fought with years before.
They were vets, he realized. This was Green Band.
Here was everything he'd wanted to know, only now Carol didn't want to know it. The outrage continued. the outrage.
Walter Trentkamp's throat had been slashed. His coat had spread open like an umbrella in the wind. His chest was bloodied, redness seeping down into his trousers. His eyes were already glazed and sightless.
Christ! Christ!
Carol tried to grab hold of something. He began to shout at the top of his voice.
Who are you, Hudson? What the hell do you want? Who sent you to Wall Street?
Outrage! Something hard crashed. The most brutal force exploded against the top of Carol's head. His skull was crushed so easily. He staggered. He almost fell, but he stayed upright. The insane street fighter inside him wouldn't go down.
God damn them!
Carol saw streaks of blood merging. He felt as if he must be going blind. The pain and chaos, the sudden light show, was unbearable inside his skull.
Who are you, Hudson?
One final, maddening question formed on his lips. He had no idea whether he spoke the words or not. He took another step toward Hudson, toward the fallen body of Montserrat, of Walter Trentkamp. The metal base of the revolver fell on his skull again. It struck the same tender spot, harder than the first time. A terrible, mashing noise echoed inside Carol's brain. Fire lit on the left side of his chest. He was falling then, collapsing against his will. Carol heard himself moaning. He had the thought that he was choking on his own blood. So sad, so wrong. The revolver crashed down another time. He spun around and saw Hudson rigidly standing there. Carol tried to speak. Shit, he couldn't. He had so many questions. He fought the onrushing unconsciousness with the strength he had left. Not much. Not enough.
Chapter 95.
With a shaking hand, Anton Birnbaum poured Fandemann port for himself and for Caitlin. He felt at least 1,000 years old. He had a piercing headache from his recent sleeplessness and hyperactive mental activity. Now, in the thin daylight that streaked his apartment, he went to the window and peered into the streets of his beloved New York. Caitlin Dillon, whose head also reeled from the hours of intense concentration without sleep, took a cigarette from her purse and started to light it. She changed her mind. Her throat was raw and there was a heavy pressure behind her eyes. What she needed, she knew, was a long sleep. Both she and Birnbaum were waiting for final news of Greenband, news from Carol. Caitlin now understood what it was like to be a policeman's wife.
We know some of what we need to know, Birnbaum said. 2 years ago, in Tripoli, Montserrat met with important leaders from the Third World. In particular, he met leaders from the Middle Eastern oil-producing countries. The heads of these nations' military forces were in attendance there as well.
Anton Birnbaum walked away from the apartment window.
I'm convinced that they planned a cunning way to disrupt the economic system of the West. Their plan called for the cartel to ultimately gain control of the entire American stock market.
They already had enough economic leverage to influence the market, Caitlin said. Her head pounded mercilessly. Some small sadist with a jackhammer was working way back in the recesses of her skull. Digging for God only knew what. She thought about Carol, who was out there in pursuit of Greenband. Why hadn't they heard anything?
That spring, our newly elected president learned of the Tripoli plot. More important, the Committee of 12 must have heard, only they moved much faster than President Kearney could in Washington.
The old man's eyes became as cold as fire going suddenly out.
Caitlin, I believe they created Greenband to counter the plot. Effectively, the Committee of 12 has stolen the Arabs' billions away. Greenband is the very finest of trompe l'oeil, the best. Now, they're selling them back their own funds. This has been an economic world war, the first of its kind, unless we include the 1970s oil embargo.
Caitlin thought that if it had been anyone other than Brennbaum making these accusations, outlining these hypotheses, but it was Brennbaum. And he was serious about everything he was proposing. How does Hudson fit in? What's his part in this, Anton? Caitlin asked.
Ah, the enigmatic Mr. Hudson.
Brennbaum allowed a smile to cross his face.
I've given great thought to Colonel Hudson.
Either he's in the pay of the Committee of 12, or they're ruthlessly using Hudson and his veterans group.
It wouldn't be the first time, would it?
It wouldn't be the first time these men were used by those who wield power in this country.
Either way, we'll know in a few hours. We'll know the truth soon, won't we?
Chapter 96. As he arrived at the designated address, Hudson felt exactly the way he'd always known he would, if they had won in Vietnam. The adrenaline, the excitement of victory, was pumping, rushing furiously through his body. This would certainly be the most unusual safe house he'd ever used, Hudson thought, as he reached York Avenue on Manhattan's fashionable east side. He entered an elegant glass and grillwork doorway just beyond the corner at 90th Street. Billy Bogan's apartment was located on the riverside of the modern building, a building which apparently had paper-thin ceilings and walls, because Hudson could hear a piano playing as he approached the doorway on the 15th floor. The lovely music surprised him. He hadn't known that Billy played. Hudson hesitated before pushing the doorbell. Warning alarm. His usual alert signals were going off again. It was all perfectly natural. One didn't stop being a military terrorist and saboteur overnight. Billy answered the door seconds after the first ring. She was wearing a pink t-shirt that said, Winter, across her chest. She had on tight black French jeans, no shoes or socks.
David.
Her brilliant blue eyes passed from the slightest puzzlement to undisguised pleasure as she saw who it was at the door. She reached out and pulled Hudson toward her. She held him in the doorway.
Was that you playing the piano? He asked.
Billy pecked at his cheek and gave him an extra hug.
Of course it was me.
You know, I think the piano is the reason I ultimately escaped from Birmingham. As I found out about Mozart, Brahms, Beethoven, I was convinced there had to be more than the dreary dullness I was used to.
Come inside.
I'm so happy to see you.
It's so good to see you.
She kissed him again. Hudson smiled more willingly than he had in a long time.
I'm happy to see you. I feel like I'm home at last, he said.
Once inside, they talked. They held one another. They stared into one another's eyes for a long time. Hudson told Billy about his past, talking with the speed of a man who has observed vows of silence for too many years. It all came tumbling out, West Point, the horrors of Vietnam, his early career in the Army. Hudson told her everything except about the past year, which he was tempted to do as well. How his revenge had become sweet victory. A material reward. Millions of dollars for himself and the other vets. He wished he could share it with her. Share everything right now. Under the tent of a brightly striped wool blanket, with the windows thrown half open, they made love. Hudson was still learning to feel, and the lovemaking helped enormously. She brought him closer and closer to climax. Right to the edge. He just couldn't make it over. Then the most debilitating wave of exhaustion swept over Hudson. He felt shaky. Then he was sliding headlong toward a tranquil dream state. The warning alarms still hadn't completely stopped. The warning alarms almost seemed a natural part of him now. One moment he was softly stroking Billy's blonde hair, touching the elegant oval of her face. The next, he was falling into sleep.
Billy lay awake in the large brass bed, watching the amber glow on a filtered cigarette. She sighed quietly, blowing smoke between lightly touching teeth. Sometimes she surprised even herself with her ability to create a lie, in perfect context, consistent with a whole world of other lies. Deception. Her being able to play Chopin, and fitting that so naturally into the Birmingham, England framework, was an inspiration. But then again, wasn't that precisely why she was here with Hudson? She rose from the double bed, tossing off rumpled designer sheets. She was certain it would be a miracle to wake Hudson with a cannon. She returned to the bedroom with something close to that, a gun with a blunt-nosed silencer attached. She knew better than to hesitate for even a second. She swung both arms up stiffly. She moved to fire the revolver into his temple, just below the hairline. Then, she hesitated. The sleeping body went rigid and jumped forward. Hudson's eyes blinked open and he fired through the bed sheets. He fired again and again and again. Warning signals were shrieking in his head. Sirens of terrible pain screamed out at David Hudson. Deception. Forever deception. Horrifying deception everywhere he turned. Even here. The Committee of 12, the American wise men, there was no way they could have let him live once Green Band ended. They had recruited him after the disappointments of Vietnam, the disappointment in knowing his early promise in the Army could never be realized. He'd been their agent provocateur for crises around the world. They had been so attractively intelligent, every bit as smart, as precise as he was. They'd sent the girl, of course, his escort. They'd known about all his habits. They'd used him so well. Finally, Hudson understood Green Band himself. Chapter 97. Carroll slowly opened his eyes and pushed himself into a sitting position. All around him were startling crashing sounds, police and U.S. Army personnel, blinding bright lights, flashing, running shapes. There was more chaos and confusion than before on the rooftop. Faces peered down at him. New York cops. A physician? There were others he couldn't place right now. The images registered sporadically. What happened? Carroll asked. How long have... What happened to the body that was up here? A body was over there. The body of Walter Trentkamp had been near the water tower, except there wasn't anybody there now. A uniformed New York cop knelt down alongside him. Carroll had never seen the man before. What other body are you talking about? Carroll rotated his head so he could see all the way around the rooftop. There was a body there, over near the Cobra. Walter Trentkamp of the FBI was killed right there. The policeman shook his head. I was one of the first up here on the roof. There wasn't any other body. You know, you've got a small watermelon growing up on top of your head. You sure you're all right? Carroll pushed himself to his feet, then he nearly fell back to the suddenly spinning cement. Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Tip-top shape. Carroll's eyes were watering badly. His body wasn't his own. Using bricks in the wall for handholds, he started down the metal stairs winding away from the roof. Somebody had taken Walter Trentkamp's body away. The cop called after him. Hey, buddy, you ought to get yourself treated. Have somebody look at your head. There wasn't anybody up here. Carroll hardly heard the policeman's last words. Suddenly, he had a different priority in mind. He wanted to go home. He needed to go home right away. Carroll thought about his kids and about Caitlin. He thought about Caitlin's meeting with Anton Birnbaum and wondered what might have transpired there. He was worried about the people he loved. There wasn't anybody up here on the roof. Sure thing. This was all a dream, a horrible nightmare. He had no clue how he managed the first wild minutes of the drive to Riverdale. Maybe it was practice, all those half-drunken nights of his recent past. Maybe God did look after babies and drunks. for there was a time coming when God might abdicate his responsibilities, all his watchfulness. And what then?
Chapter 98. The familiar lights of the old house in Riverdale were glittering brightly. As he drove up his street, Carol remembered a time when his father and mother would have been there, a time when everything had seemed so much saner, when Trent Camp was Uncle Walter. Walter Trent Camp had been his father's friend for all those years. Had his father begun to guess anything? We had all been so naive about foreign governments back then, about our own government as it was turning out. Americans thought of democracy as the world's one superior political system. We thought we understood the parameters of our government's power. Trent Camp and the KGB had been brilliant at fooling everyone. Walter Trent Camp had been so confident he hadn't hesitated at using Carol. What better conduit for information? Walter's hubris was startling, but his modus was consistent at least. As Carol thought back now, he remembered that Walter had spent time in Europe after World War II. He recalled fact-finding trips to South America, to Mexico, to Southeast Asia. It was no wonder they had never been able to identify Montserrat. They hadn't been looking in the right places. No one had thought to look right there in New York or Washington. No one had begun to suspect Trent Camp, and Trent Camp had obviously known that they wouldn't. His confidence was galling. He had no fear or respect for American intelligence, and he had been right not to. His ruse, the misdirection, had been perfect. The life work of a master spy, this decade's Donald McLean or Kim Philby. Suddenly, Carol's eyes were watering again, only now it was because he was so glad to see his kids. They jumped up and ran to him as he stumbled inside the house. Then the Carol family was hugging and kissing. They were squeezing their father as tightly as they could. "We have to get out of here," Carol whispered to Mary Catherine, as the two of them got to hold one another. "We have to move out of the house now. Help me dress them. Try to explain as little as you can. I have to call Caitlin." Mary Catherine nodded. She didn't even seem that surprised at the news. "You go call Caitlin now. I'll outfit the troops." 2 hours later, the Carrolls, the family of six plus Caitlin Dillon, quietly checked into the Durham Hotel on West 87th Street in Manhattan. Carol's plan was to stay there for a night, maybe a few nights, until they could decide how to work with Anton Birnbaum, how to work with the New York police, whoever they could trust. Life was suddenly full of treacherous false bottoms. Carol didn't want another one to suddenly fall out. Once they were together in the West Side Hotel, Caitlin and Carol fell into an embrace. They shared a long kiss which neither of them wanted to end. Caitlin pushed against Carol with a fierce need. There was no more reason to hide anything, to hold back her feelings. "I love you." She locked her eyes into Carol's gaze. "I love you, Caitlin. I was afraid today. I thought that I might never see you again." They made love in the hotel room, and it was all passion, definitely not Lima, Ohio. When they did it a second time, Caitlin and Carol held hands, almost as if they might never do this beautiful thing again. "I hated it when you were out there after them," Caitlin finally whispered as she lay beside Carol. Her breath was like feathers on his cheekbone. "I've never felt so alone and afraid. I don't want to feel that way again." Carol brushed strands of hair away from her face. She was so precious to him. "I told Walter Trent Camp that I planned to quit once Green Band was over. I haven't changed my mind." Caitlin stared into his eyes. "There's a catch, though." "Yes, there's one catch. Green Band isn't over. There was so much evidence to be considered and studied. There were classified files from the FBI and Pentagon. There were taped statements from Birnbaum's contacts in Washington and Europe. They just had to get to the right people with what they knew, with the truth. Who were the right people, though? Whom could they trust now? The New York Times?
The Washington Post, 60 Minutes, the New York Police, the CIA. The Committee of 12 seemed to be everywhere. Were they connected with the police, the CIA? Did they control the newspapers and TV? Whom could they go to with the truth? During the first hours in the hotel, Carol and Caitlin read every newspaper report. Twice that afternoon, Carol took cabs to the large out-of-town newspaper stand in Times Square. He and Caitlin read and reread everything written about Greenband. They searched for a faint shadow of what they knew to be the truth. There was none that they could find. Nothing had been reported about secret intra-government groups. Nothing had been reported about the whereabouts of Walter Trenkamp. Had the body been spirited away by the 12? Nothing was said about Colonel David Hudson's special forces training at Fort Bragg. In the news, Colonel Hudson was described as a jackal-like provocateur, the renegade mastermind of Greenband. Hudson was depicted as an obsessed man looking for justice, some personal meaning, years after Vietnam. It all sounded plausible and right, if you didn't know any better. Chapter 99. The morning of December 21st, Caitlin and Carol had visitors at the hotel. The visitors were Anton Birnbaum and Samantha Hawes, the FBI researcher who had helped Carol in Washington. They met in another room on the same floor as the Carol suite. The best and the worst part of the Greenband investigation had begun. The tension and pressure were even more relentless than before. Carol's stomach had been doing an uncomfortable dance of panic for the past 24 hours. A working picture of Greenband was emerging. If not a complete portrait, it was at least an outline, a foreshadowing of the truth. The story was different from anything reported in the newspapers or on TV.
The 12, the American wise men, are descended from our own OSS. America's intelligence team during World War II, Birnbaum said in a voice that seemed to grow weaker each day. The route is serpentine, but it can be followed. The existence of the 12 goes back to the elder Dulles, his reluctance to surrender his wartime intelligence machine over to the politicians in 1940s Washington. When the OSS was transformed into the CIA, the 12 began to meet outside official circles. They were still the most powerful men in Washington. At first, they gave counsel. Then they took things into their own able hands. The original OSS was the best American intelligence unit ever. The 12 still smugly believe they are the elite. They are convinced they are doing the country a grand service, guiding us through the Cuban Missile threat, the time of the assassinations, Watergate, now Greenband. Every year, each decade, they become more and more powerful.
Samantha Hawes spoke after Birnbaum. She had information about Hudson. She had managed to retrieve some of the missing Betts files during the past few days. David Hudson was approached by at least one committee member when he was still in the Army, while he was at Fort Bragg after Vietnam, she told the others. General Lucas Thompson, his old commander, approached Hudson first. Thompson knew everything about Hudson's POW experiences. He knew about Hudson's training at Fort Bragg, too. Army intelligence had prepared Hudson to be there, Juan Carlos. They backed off when Hudson lost his arm. Well, the committee had plenty of uses for Hudson and his skill. Another interesting note, Philip Berger of the CIA ran Hudson's original commando training at Fort Bragg. Several committee members have spoken at Veteran Affairs over the past few years. The connections are there. The manipulation is feasible. Carol had read the missing FBI and Pentagon files which Hawes had brought with her. Hudson was given a lot of help with Greenband. The help came in the form of Wall Street information and tips about what we were doing inside Number 13. That's why he was able to play so many cat-and-mouse games. He also had Pentagon files on all the candidates for vets. Hudson chose men who'd served with him in Vietnam. The committee promised him millions as a reward.
Yes, only half the vets are dead now,
Birnbaum spoke.
The rest are missing. Hudson is missing. Where is David Hudson now, I wonder?
Caitlin had been quiet for most of the session. She had retrieved the necessary financial backup information. She was still angry. She felt used by this committee, which believed it was above the government, above laws.
We're beginning to make progress, Caitlin finally spoke in a quiet manner. But we're still faced with an overwhelming problem. Whom do we trust beyond the people here in this room? Do we take our information to the newspapers? Do we go to the FBI, Samantha? Whom can we tell this story to?
There was silence in the room. They were all beginning to understand the power that was in the grasp of a select few. They were beginning to understand the real political system. The question remaining was so simple, yet so impossibly complex.
Whom could they trust with the truth?
Chapter 100. For another 24 hours on December 22nd, the Carrolls lived in cramped quarters in the West Side Hotel. They had no other choice to consider.
Whom could they trust?
Late at night, Carol and Caitlin stayed in the smaller of the two bedrooms. They lay in each other's arms, passing the long, eerie hours. They were realistic enough to know that something nightmarish might still happen, that they might never be together like this again.
Hudson said something on the rooftop in Brooklyn, Carol whispered as he stroked Caitlin's hair. He said that he loved his country. You know, I still feel that way. I almost feel closer to Hudson than to the others.
Caitlin nodded. Her eyes were stinging when she finally whispered to Carol,
I feel so angry at whoever was deceiving all of us, at the ones who lied and misled us all these years.
When Caitlin and Carol made love, it was more tender than it had ever been. They fell asleep holding each other, like children allowed to sleep together during a storm. At 6 o'clock, Caitlin found that she couldn't sleep anymore. She pushed herself up in bed. When she switched on a tiny portable radio, Caitlin heard the last thing she wanted to hear in all the world. Caitlin heard the news that finally broke her heart.
Advisor to several U.S. presidents, Anton Birnbaum was killed on Riverside Drive near his home in Manhattan early today. The elderly statesman was struck in late-night traffic by an unidentified hit-and-run driver. Birnbaum was 83 years old at the time of his death.
Caitlin shook Carol until he mumbled and finally blinked awake. In a voice that was racked by sobs, she began to tell him what had happened.
Oh, Arch, they killed him. They killed Anton this morning. They killed him as if he was nothing. What's happening now? What's going to happen?
Carol shivered as he got up from bed. He dressed, then hurried down to Broadway, where he bought the Daily News, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. All the front-page stories about Anton Birnbaum contained respectful eulogies. They also contained lies. At best, the newspapers revealed a small fragment of the truth. At the newsstand, Carol read the articles with trembling fingers. It was as if nothing real had ever happened. There was no high-placed traitor in the FBI. There was no Montserrat, no mention of the whereabouts of Colonel Hudson. That same morning, trudging back to the hotel from Broadway, Carol saw the two men following him.
There was no way anyone connected with Green Band could live.
Chapter 101. Escape. It was the only possibility left. On the night of December 23rd, Carol, Caitlin, the four children, and Mary Catherine tightly locked hands. They walked down Columbus Avenue. There had to be a way for three adults and four small children to escape a surveillance team. So far, Carol had found none. for the New York crowds would provide temporary safety. Columbus Avenue was still buzzing with holiday music and a festive bustle at night. The energetic crowd, every other person holding a bright Christmas bundle, a tree, a Lincoln Center program, parted reluctantly for the family. It wasn't like any Christmas that Carol had ever known before. It was as if a terrible, unfathomable darkness lurked in the shadows between the bright lights and the fir trees. Caitlin, Mary Kay, the kids. How could he shield them when he felt that some unknown gunman lingered in every doorway?
"Can we please stop running, Daddy? Please?"
A tiny voice trailed after Carol, echoing thinly inside the symphony of the New York City street noise. The bizarre cacophony of Christmas sounds wouldn't stop, wouldn't let up for a moment of relief. Why did he think it would? 4-year-old Lizzie was dragging herself along on the hem of his sports coat.
"Please, Daddy, just for a minute, please."
Up ahead of them, Caitlin and Mary Catherine had the 3 other children in tow. They were bravely hurrying the children forward. Carol finally stopped and stooped to wrap his arms around his little girl. He whispered soothingly against Lizzie's chilled, red-rimmed ear. "Please, baby, please be good. Just a little longer, sweetheart." Carol immediately straightened again. It was so sad what he was almost certain was going to happen next. It was so unfair. He had reached the most hollow place of his existence, a terrible numbness around his heart. He gazed north, then down the bright lights of Columbus Avenue. His weary eyes brushed over colorful signs that said, Sedutos, Diane, Pershing, La Cantina. Columbus Avenue had changed dramatically since he'd last been above 72nd Street. The area had once been crowded with Spanish food stores as well as transient hotels and oriental rug dealers. Now it was a trendy, self-conscious version of Greenwich Village. Carol glanced over his shoulder again. The same pair of men was still following. Now, though, there were more than 2. There were as many as 5 men following the Carol family. And they were closer, no more than half a city block away. "Where in the name of God do we go? Somebody help us," he thought to himself. The back of Carol's neck was soaking wet. Even in the chill air, his skin, his brown hair, was plastered against his shirt collar. He was hopelessly tired. He felt he could lay down on a parked car, sleep right there in the middle of Columbus Avenue. The passers-by looked so preoccupied, so self-interested and city cool. Would any of them help? Carol's mind was silently screaming, pleading for some form of reason to finally prevail. "This is happening," he thought. "Whether I choose to believe it or not, this is happening." Escape was the only reality. He had one idea, a kind of prayer, which he didn't think could work. His mind was close to bursting. There was nothing left but rage, the constant, maddening stab of fear. He could see the same emotion pressed onto Caitlin's face. As for Mary Catherine, her face looked blank. All its usual ruddy color was gone. He reached out suddenly for Caitlin. He held her narrow shoulders. "Listen to me. Listen closely." He whispered something hopeful, something so innocent it started tears in her soft brown eyes. "I love you so much, Caitlin. Everything has to be all right." "Oh, Arch, why now? Why now?" Then Carol pushed her away. He sent Caitlin and his sister and the tangle of children in the opposite direction, up 72nd Street, away, far away from him. "I'm going down Columbus. Take them. Take them away, please. Caitlin, take them now."
"Daddy! Daddy!"
The final thing Carol heard was his baby's cries as he raced away. As he put his head down, chin into his heaving chest, as he started to run as fast as he could along the clogged sidewalk. Suddenly, powerful arms grabbed him, wrenched him to a spinning stop. A hand clamped down hard, twisting into his face. Searing pain ripped through Carol's eyes. His mind was racing. They were attacking him in the middle of New York City, in one of the most crowded residential areas of the city. They had come for him in full view of 100 witnesses.
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 8. Black Friday by James Patterson. Continuing on page 435. They didn't even care about the witnesses anymore.
Get the hell off me! Get off me, you pieces of shit!
Carol's shouts rose like fighting kites above the honking horns, above the city's deafening street rumble.
Somebody, please help!
They were giving him a needle. Some kind of long, terrifying needle pierced through his trousers into his leg. They were giving it to him right out here in the open. Right on West 70th Street in New York City.
Somebody help! Somebody fucking help!
There were obviously no secrets anymore. There was no bullshit pretense that this was a police bust, that they were New York detectives.
Get off! No needle. No!
Carol roared his last words savagely. He screamed and he fought back. He clawed at them with his remaining strength. He broke a jaw with a short, powerful punch. His elbow smashed hard into a forehead. A bone snapped loudly. His? Everything was unreal. Everything was impossible to comprehend or slow down even a fraction. Carol was being dragged into a dark blue sedan. He was being held upside down. He looked back as they pulled him off Columbus Avenue, out of the crowds. As he was hanging upside down, he saw the second car arrive. He saw Caitlin and his sister and the kids being snatched away.
Not the kids! You goddamned bastards! Not my kids! Not my kids! No, please, not my kids!
Chapter 102. Thomas Moore Elliott's palms were dry and cold. He suppressed a nervous tic which was starting to pulse in his throat. He finally stepped out of the dark blue stretch limousine and into the chill Virginia winter air. Dead trees hung against the gray skyline, and in the distance there were the gunshots of bird hunters. He turned and walked up the field stone steps that led to the large double doors of an imposing 30-room country house. He paused at the top of the steps and sucked air deeply into his lungs. Inside, the cavernous front hall was badly overheated. He felt a trickle of sweat run along his collar with the stealth of an insect. His footsteps echoed on marble as he crossed to a great curving flight of stairs that led upward to the floors above. It was not a house that Elliot enjoyed. Its very size, but more, its history made him uncomfortable. When he reached the landing, he came to a door ornately carved out of walnut. It shone so deeply from years of meticulous care that he could see his own indistinct reflection in the wood. He opened the door and entered the room beyond. A group of men sat around a long, polished oak table. They were dressed mostly in dark business suits. Some of them, including General Lucas Thompson, were retired military and naval commanders. Some ran large multinational corporations. Others were influential bankers, landowners, proprietors of TV stations and newspapers. The man at the top of the table, a retired admiral whose bald head shone in the room like a bone, waved one hand at the vice president.
"Sit down, Thomas. Sit, please."
The vice president sat. The admiral smiled, and it wasn't an expression of mirth. There was an immediate silence in the room.
"A year ago," the admiral said, "we met in this very room. Our mood that day was one of some agitation."
There was a polite ripple of laughter. Self-satisfied laughter spread around the formal library table.
"We debated, I'm sure we all remember, the complex problem posed by the so-called Red Tuesday Plan, the plan hatched, if that's the word, by the oil-producing nations in Tripoli. There were rather heated arguments that day."
The admiral smiled. Elliot thought he resembled a smug school principal on award day at a private academy.
"On that day, we reached a decision, unanimous,
to create what we called Green Band. I believe the name was something I suggested myself, a name with both financial and military connotation. A bird appeared against the casement window of the room, a bleak little sparrow that briefly looked in, then hopped off into the late afternoon light. The Admiral continued in sanctimonious tone. We are here today to confirm that the paramilitary operation called Green Band was a success. We created temporary panic in the economic system, a panic we were able to control. We usurped the terrorist plan known as Red Tuesday. The world will find Jimmy Hoffa before they locate the body of Francois Montserrat. And with the destruction of Green Band, the inevitable death of our volatile associate, Colonel Hudson, the file should be closed on this unfortunate episode in our history. We are making every effort to make certain that it is. Elliot shifted his body in his chair. The atmosphere in the large room was changing subtly. The men were beginning to loosen up, to move toward as celebratory an atmosphere as they might ever aspire to, which meant muted, quiet, and, most of all, tasteful. The Admiral said, In approximately 2 weeks, Justin Kearney will dramatically resign his presidency. He will be remembered chiefly as a scapegoat for the economic near tragedy. More importantly, though, and here all eyes in the room turned toward Thomas More Elliott, Thomas Elliott will ascend to that office. There was an outbreak of applause. Elliott looked around at the 11 men in the room. His own presence brought the number to an even dozen. Later, said the Admiral, there will be champagne and cigars. For the moment, Thomas, our congratulations to you, and I thank to everyone in this room. The Admiral looked reflective for a moment. In a few weeks, for the first time, one of us will occupy the highest office in the land, and that means our control is tighter, more sure than ever before. The Admiral looked down at the white hair on the back of his hand. Which means we will no longer need to contend with a president who doesn't think the way we do, someone who imagines his power is independent of what we bestow. Thomas More Elliott stared off into the gray light that lay against the window. He blinked his pale eyes twice. He licked his lips, which had become dry. He opened his mouth and his throat felt parched. He realized that he was about to say something that would not contribute to the general mood of contentment within the room. But that couldn't be helped. He didn't like the prospect, but somebody had to deliver the news. He said, I have heard from our people in New York City. 11 heads swiveled toward him. A man called Archer Carroll is in police custody there. A silent pause came to the room with all the suddenness of a stilled pulse. It is my information that he is talking, that he's telling his story to anyone who will listen, and that media representatives are paying close attention. The silence was a long, unhappy thing. Thomas More Elliott sipped his tepid water. What does he know? The Admiral asked eventually. Everything, the Vice President said. Chapter 103 New York Police Sergeant Joe Macchio and Patrolman Gene McGinnis were rolling out of the wooded 72nd Street transverse through Central Park when they spotted a scene they wished they hadn't spotted, especially not so close to the end of their 4 to 12 o'clock night shift. This is car 138. Please give me immediate assistance at 72nd Street and Central Park West. Patrolman McGinnis, a tall, skinny woman with an impassive face, was already speaking into the patrol car radio. The red police bubble on top of their cruiser had begun to revolve. Up ahead on 72nd Street, traveling at maybe 50 or 55 miles per hour, was a dark blue Lincoln. That wasn't the problem. The problem was some suicidal or homicidal maniac trying to wiggle out of the shattered backseat window of the Lincoln. He had his torso halfway out. The only thing holding him inside were two other men. They looked as if they were trying to land an ocean-sized fish in the speeding vehicle. Look, look there, the second car behind, McGinnis pointed straight ahead.
Inside the second car, children, a host of screaming kids, seemed to be fighting and struggling to get out.
God fucking damn it, Joe Machio growled, even louder. He had been dreaming of Christmas Day, and something of the peaceful spirit had created a glow inside him. Now all that was gone. Sergeant Machio and Patrolman McGinnis left their police cruiser with revolvers drawn. They cautiously approached the two sedans, now stopped against the southwest corner of 72nd. Other police, blue and whites, sirens screaming, were already racing up 72nd from the direction of Broadway.
"We're federal agents." A man in a dark suit burst out of the lead sedan. He was holding out a portfolio wallet and an official-looking badge.
"I don't care if you're the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army," Sergeant Machio croaked in his most convincing street cop voice. "What the hell's going on here? Who the hell's this guy? Why are all these kids screaming like somebody's being murdered?"
A second dark-suited man stepped out of the trailing sedan.
"I'm Victor Kenyon of the CIA, officer." He said it calmly, but authoritatively. "I think I can explain this whole thing."
Carol was still half in, half out of the back window of the lead sedan. He was groggy, almost out on his feet. He hollered at the two police officers.
"Hey, please!" His speech was slurred. "My kids, they're in danger. I'm a federal officer."
Sergeant Machio couldn't help himself. He started to laugh.
"Not that I think this is funny, pal.
You're a federal officer?"
10 minutes later, the situation wasn't any closer to being solved. Several more police, blue and whites, had arrived. So had cars from the New York FBI and more from the CIA.
There was a cluster of police officials on 72nd Street. Two EMS ambulances had pulled up, but Caitlin and Mary Catherine wouldn't let them take Carol to Roosevelt Hospital, or any place else without them.
Caitlin was yelling at the policemen, telling them that she and Carol were part of the Green Band investigation team. She had proof in her pocketbook. The CIA agents had lots of impressive proof that they were who they said they were. The arguing continued on the corner of 72nd Street, getting more heated with every passing moment. It began to draw a New York sidewalk crowd. Mickey Kevin Carroll finally sidled up to Sergeant Machio, who had walked off to try to think the whole crazy thing out.
"Can I see your hat?" Mickey Kevin asked.
"My dad's a policeman. He doesn't get to wear a hat."
Joe Machio looked down at the small boy and offered a tired smile.
"And which one is your dad?" he asked.
"Is your dad here now?"
"That's my dad."
Mickey Kevin pointed at the man slumped, seemingly sleeping on an EMS litter cot, looking like Crusader Rabbit one final time.
"He's a policeman, son?"
"Yes, sir."
Well, that settled it for Sergeant Machio, because the alleged CIA agents were claiming that the other man definitely wasn't a police officer.
"That's what I needed to know, son. That's what I needed to know for starters, anyway."
NYPD Sergeant Machio stooped down and handed Mickey Kevin his hat. Then he walked in the direction of the disturbance that had closed down 72nd Street, not to mention the downtown lanes of Central Park West and the Park Transverse.
"Tell you what we're gonna do, eh?" Sergeant Machio clapped his hands for a little old-fashioned order and attention. "We're gonna sort this all out down at the station house."
At that news, the entire Carroll family started to do a very odd thing. At least Sergeant Machio and the rest of the New York cops thought it was peculiar. The kids started to bawl out cheer and clap for the NYPD. The New York cops weren't used to that. A couple of the older patrolmen started to blush. They'd almost never been treated like the arriving cavalry before, like the good guys in the white hat.
All right now. Everybody pile into the wagon. Let's get this show on the road. See who's been naughty and nice, eh?"
Photographs of the scene were snapped by somebody from the New York Times, also by a freelance photojournalist who lived across 72nd Street in the Dakota. A shot of Mickey Kevin wearing Sergeant Machio's hat was featured in Newsweek magazine. Eventually, the Newsweek shot of Mickey Kevin appeared framed on the Carroll's Riverdale house mantle. Lizzie, Mary III, and Clancy all loudly complained about favoritism. Arch told them to shut their yaps. So much had happened to them in a relatively short time. Not the least of it was that Arch had fallen in love with Caitlin, and slowly, but surely, so had the kids. They were all family now, weren't they? They truly were family. Epilogue. Hudson. Chapter 104. A line to the President of the United States signaled through at 6 on the morning of March 7th. Clustered inside the Oval Office were most of the members of the National Security Council. Not one of the officials could believe what was happening. A pre-recorded message came over the telephone. The White House is scheduled to be firebombed this morning in a matter of a few minutes. This decision is irrevocable. This decision is non-negotiable. You are to evacuate the White House immediately. Inside a telephone booth less than a mile from the White House, David Hudson pushed down the recording machine's stop button. He stuffed the compact recorder into the pocket of his fatigue jacket. Hudson was actually smiling. For the briefest moment, Hudson laughed out loud. All of Washington waited, for the White House was never struck that morning. Instead, the home of General Lucas Thompson was firebombed. So was the home of Vice President Elliott, the homes of Admiral Thomas Penney, of Philip Bridger, of Lawrence Guthrie. 12 homes in all. David Hudson finally climbed into a light green touring van. He drove west out of the strikingly lovely capital city. For a moment, at least, no nightmare voices screeched inside his head. His arm had stopped aching, the arm that was no longer there. He had done the right thing, he believed, especially for his men, the other vets. They had scattered like leaves after a fierce storm. He hoped they would prosper, or at least be at peace. Finally, they had justice. Finally, there was an end to deception. End of Black Friday by James Patterson. Read by Bob Moore in the studios of Potomac Talking Book Services, Incorporated for the Library of Congress. November 2000. Published by Warner Vision, Warner Books, Incorporated, 1271 Avenue of the Americas, New York, New York, 10020. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.